அன்னை அன்பர்கள் அனைவருக்கும் எங்கள் இனிய காலை வணக்கங்கள். இன்று வெப் மீட்டிங் லைவ் டிவைன் சந்திரசேகரன் அவர்களும் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். அன்பர்கள் அனைவரும் பொறுமை காட்டி இந்த நிகழ்ச்சியில் பங்கெடுக்குமாறு கேட்டுக்கொள்கிறோம். முதலாவது
Thank you, Vijayaraj. Good morning. Today we take up chapter 22, The Problem of Life. This is the fourth chapter in Life Divine on life, and by now we should be able to understand not only what is the problem but what is the solution. So Ringo's purpose in writing this is to tell us how life can be made divine. But for us it has a more immediate practical application as to how we can solve all the problems that we encounter in life and accomplish all that we want to accomplish. And this really is, if we fully understand his message, a practical guide for that purpose. As always, he starts with an overview. He starts with a review of what we've learned about life. He tells us that life is the creation of the conscious force of such a member. Life is not an illusion. Life is not a bad dream. Life is not a nightmare. Life is not an evil force. It is in its origin the conscious force of Satchidananda. It is in it, absolute, possessed of unity and the light of being, the light of existence. It is also in its origin undivided. All forms of life, all forces of life are part of a single unified action of the divine. But that's not how we experience it. We experience life as divided up into many, many different people, that's us, many different forces, many different groups, classes, castes, communities, companies, families, all clashing with one another, competing with one another, bumping into one another, stumbling over one another in an attempt to solve their own problems and get the maximum that we can, each of us. Even in our beliefs, we find that life is a clashing set of truths. Some people say, let's be practical. Other people, let's say, be very devoted. Some people talk about every man for himself. Some people talk about, let us all be equal. So life is, in its appearance, a clash of contradictory forces. While in its essence, it is one united divine force manifesting in the universe. And he tells us that we are really misrepresenting, we are not seeing life or understanding life as it really is. The truth of life is behind the veil, and our task is to remove that veil and discover that truth. India is divided by language, community, caste, and so many things. We know that India is Mother India, it's United India. But for those who are living in the country, you know how divided it is by language, by caste, by community, by state, by political party, and so forth. That is the surface the truth of the unity is behind. The solution for us is to get to that hidden truth and that hidden unity. And he tells us the reason for this distorted appearance of life is because life is evolving through a series of stages. Imagine Jane Austen when she creates Pride and Prejudice. Her goal is to create a romantic love story that brings out the heights of love and human happiness, accomplishment. But how does she start? She starts with a clash, with a conflict. Darcy calls her follower. Wickham calls him a scoundrel. Darcy interferes with Jane Lindley because they are two different classes. Everything, Elizabeth hates Darcy. Everything is a clash of forces. And yet in the end, it comes up as a romantic performance. Why does she start with a clash of forces? Well, when we go through the story, we find it is actually through that clash of forces that romance develops, that the true depth of Darcy's love and acceptance of her manifests itself. And there's a similar truth in the method that the Divine has chosen to manifest in the universe. And we saw in earlier chapters that life has passed through three stages in its emergence. In the first chapter called Life, he describes life as a subconscious movement in nature, in material nature, in the plant, a mechanical force acting. We don't normally think of the matter as alive, as objects as alive. But he says there is a hidden will, a hidden force in them. But it doesn't walk, it doesn't talk, it doesn't respond to us, it acts mechanically, like the forces of nature which science studies. But that's only the first stage. Then we see miraculously, out of this inert, inconscient material substance, life forms emerge. Plants that grow, that lean towards the sun, that go seeking after water. Insects and animals and fish that respond to each other, that grow, that multiply, that are driven by partially conscious instincts. The animal is aware of his environment. He has sensory awareness. He sees things, he hears things, he smells things. There's a consciousness, not like the sun, which doesn't seem to even notice us when we pass by. But it's very limited. This consciousness is still very much submerged. And then with us, with the human being, mind emerges. And consciousness comes out in a much greater measure. We think, we feel, we express ourselves. We are able to remember the past. We don't know that animals remember what happened on their last birthday. We're able to think of the future. I wonder what I'm going to do when I retire or after marriage. Our field of consciousness is much greater. We wonder who created the world and how it got created and where it's going and what's going to happen in the future. So our span of consciousness is much, much greater. But he tells us that this is still a very limited consciousness. Because the consciousness buried in matter, the consciousness buried in the unconscious is infinite. Infinite, absolute, all-powerful, and united. And the problem of Christ, he's going to tell us in this chapter, will really be fully solved for earth, for universe, when we discover that undivided, infinite power of love. He told us in the first chapter about the human aspiration. We have an aspiration, humanity's always had an aspiration for life, freedom, truth, immortality. And he says that aspiration is really the aspiration of the hidden divine in us, the divine buried within us, the life, the infinite life that wants to come out and express itself. That is which is what is in aspiring in us. That is the flame in our soul that wants to come out and manifest itself in an immortal life. But our starting condition is one of ignorance. We are like Percy. When he sees Elizabeth the first time, he says, she's tolerable. He's very proud of himself. He thinks he's the perfect gentleman. He's not even aware how other people see him. He looks down on other people as savages who dance. The problem that Darcy has in winning Elizabeth is the problem that we all have. We don't know ourselves, we don't know everybody else, we don't know the world in which we live. So the truth is that Satchitananda buried within us, in the depths of our being, in our psychic, wills to come out and manifest itself. That's what we're here for. That's what life is all about. And when Wickham comes and scandalizes Darcy, it's not the illusion of an evil life. It's the awakening call for him to discover his soul and to release the bitter truth within him. Now he tells us something very important that helps us, the key to the whole understanding of life. He tells us the principle that as is the consciousness, so is the force. And he explains this by tracing four different poles or relationships between the consciousness and the force. He started by saying that life is essentially the conscious force of the divine. It's infinite, not our daily experience, I think. He says this is the first poise. The first poise of consciousness in force is that it has in Satchitananda, when the consciousness and force are one, when the consciousness is infinite, embraces everything, organizes everything, pervades everything, when the force is infinite, transcends everything, has all knowledge and all power. So, if we reach Satchitananda, we don't have this problem of ignorance, we don't have a problem of impotence, because consciousness and force are one. This is the force, this is the truth that created the world. But it's not the world as we experience. There's a second poise of that the relationship. It's the poise of material nature. Now what's the situation in material nature? We don't see any consciousness at all. We see only force, mechanical force. The wind blows, the chemicals react, electricity flows. There doesn't seem to be any consciousness at all. The consciousness and the force are totally separated from one another. Rather, the consciousness is buried, it's lost in the inconscient, and therefore, the force we experience doesn't have any of the attributes that we associate with such a denial. The force doesn't decide what to do, it doesn't have power, it just works in a mechanical, repetitive way, helplessly, because it's not conscious. So the key for us is, if we want to have mastery in life, we can only have mastery in the measure we're conscious. And this is the central theme of the chapter. If we have a problem, whatever the problem is, it is essentially a problem of consciousness. That's not our understanding. Our understanding is life is not cooperating with us, other people don't know what to do, nobody understands me, I'm not getting the money I need, I'm not getting the bride or bridegroom I want. We don't understand, customers are not coming to my company, banks are not giving me the money. We think the problem is everywhere. We don't realize the problem is in consciousness, and not their consciousness, our consciousness. So these are very important principles for us. And all that comes to us, we don't know, Darcy doesn't know why wickedness is telling lies about him and scandalizing him. And thinks, I'm a perfectly good gentleman, everything's all right with me, I didn't do any of the things, why is that man harassing them? He doesn't realize this is a wake-up call for him. He doesn't realize that every time he goes into a dance and looks down at people, all these savages are dancing and she's a tolerable girl and her mother's an idiot. He doesn't realize that he has a problem of consciousness. And the source of life, abusing him, scandalizing him, for nothing he's really done. Wickham trying to elope with Georgiana. He feels attacked by life. Why is life persecuting me? Why are people doing anything to anybody? Of course, he did interfere with Jane's marriage to Bingley, but he won't count that. He doesn't realize the problem originates in his own consciousness. There's a third phase of the relationship of consciousness and force. This is where we are. This is the point in which we are, in which consciousness is divided. Each of us is looking at life, each of us is looking at the world through our own eyes, through our own point of view. Of course, that's the correct point of view, right? We are all divided. But if you remember, in Satchitananda, there's no division. Satchitananda is aware of the same consciousness in all. But I have to admit, when I wake up in the morning, I'm aware of my problems, what I have to do. It's only by an extra effort that I think that somebody else has problems and maybe I can help solve them. I look at everything from my own point of view. We each look from our own individual center. We are not aware of the fundamental spiritual fact. We're all in this together. We're all in this together, and if other people get, I will get. Because in a sense we are all, in a very true sense, we are all one. But that's not our experience. That's not the experience of Mrs. Bennett when Bingley comes to Meriden. She says, quick, Mr. Bennett, go and call on him before Lady Lucas and Mrs. Long. Because I must get the Bingley for my husband for one of my daughters. Quickly. I won't miss any opportunity to tell him how plain Charlotte Lucas is. Unfortunately, she's a nice girl, but she's very plain. Nobody would like to marry her. She'll probably never get married. I'm eager to go and tell Mrs. Lady Lucas that Bingley's going to marry Jane, and it's a great triumph for me, because she looks at everybody else as a competitor. She thinks she's alone, even her competition is with her husband. When Collins comes, she thinks, I will get Collins for Lizzie. I won't even tell him Mr. Bennett, what's going on. She lives in her own world. All the problems arise because we live in our own isolated, egoist consciousness and consider everybody else a competitor. And struggle, there's 10 other people in my department, I must get the promotion, I must become first. in everything, I must get the best marks and show that I'm better. I won't help anyone else because then they may get better marks than me. We live in the divided consciousness of the third voice of being. And he says, we are in the process of emerging out of the great denial. The great denial is matter, which seems to deny the existence of the divine, which seems to deny the existence of consciousness. We are in a kind of a halfway position where we recognize our consciousness, we recognize there are other conscious beings, but we have not yet arrived at the great affirmation. The great affirmation is we are one divine, and we are all one. And all our problems will be solved when we realize that. And that's the third poise, the poise of supermind. When we reach supermind, we will be in possession not only of the unity of oneness, but also the diversity. We will recognize the individuality of everybody, including ourselves, but also the oneness of everybody with each other. We will see the movement of forces, but we will also understand the unity that that movement is going through. We'll see Bingley marries Jane, Darcy marries Elizabeth, Wickham becomes a son-in-law, but they are all movements of an underlying expressions of the social evolution of England. The whole society is evolving. There's a unity there. Everybody is moving individually, but as part of a grand movement. We'll be aware of the grand evolutionary movement, and all problems will be solved. So there's a fundamental principle in this chapter in which he's telling us we can only have power over that which we're conscious of. If we don't have power, consciousness, we won't have power. Mr. Bennett wants to send Lydia to Brighton. He refuses to think about the danger. He refuses to take Lydia's warning. He refuses to be conscious, even when warned. Who else refuses to be conscious? Lizzie refused to be conscious when Carolyn warned her about Wickham, when Mrs. Gardner warned her, when Jane told her what Bingley said, even when Darcy wrote the letter. She refused to fully recognize the truth of Wickham. And what we find is, wherever we refuse to be fully conscious, we have problems. When life brings us a knowledge and we ignore it. Mrs. Bennett doesn't want to know what Lizzie says about Collins. Well, you must marry Collins. I want the entail, so I am sure of my home and future. She never thinks from Lizzie's point of view. She never even thinks whether Collins will be happy with Lizzie. She never consults her husband. It's a conscious, willful ignorance that generates problems. The next minute, Collins goes and marries Charlotte Lucas, and she loses the entail.
Sir, in the previous chapters, we were also discussing about mind. About mind, supermind, and mind is actually being controlled by supermind. So that was what we were discussing in the earlier previous chapter. Now, we are talking about consciousness. So, in the example that what you said that when Lydia wanted to go to Britain and Bennett was not conscious even after he was being advised by his own people. So, sir, in this he's acting on the, in the level of mind. So how is a mind and consciousness which can be drawn a line which says that whatever comes to me, I used to have based on my previous knowledge and track record that I have got. But the consciousness is one, if somebody tells me that you should not go there, but my mind says that going there is for a better opportunity. So should I listen to my mind that is telling it is a better opportunity, or should I listen to others telling that thinking that it is? I have to be consciousness to listen what they are saying. So I am in a still. I am a still position. Either I am, if I look into the differentiation of what we are speaking, I am not able to do what my mind says, and I am not able to take what the other people says that you have to be conscious. So.
Mr. Bennett is not in the mental consciousness when he sends Lydia to pray. He refuses to think rationally. He refuses to listen. He refuses to consider. He knows his daughter. Nobody needs to tell him how irresponsible and impulsive she is. And she's been calling Dear Wickham, and she's been trying to be the first one married. An officer, she uses her head. So it's not because he was in the mental consciousness that he did that. It's because he wanted peace and quiet. He wanted a vital convenience. He wanted to be left alone. He was acting irresponsibly. Life challenged his view when Lizzie came. So whatever motive Lizzie had, and whatever was the truth of it, it was an announcement to him that his view is partial. When we use the word consciousness with a capital C, Aurobindo uses it, he means the totality of consciousness of the divine. Mind is also consciousness. It's a limited consciousness. Ego is also in consciousness, but it's a limited consciousness. Vital is also conscious, but it's a limited consciousness. When we use the term consciousness, is it the full consciousness of Satchidananda or Supermind, or is it even the storm, consciousness in the storm, but it's so buried we can't see it? There's consciousness in the plant, we discussed it earlier, there's consciousness in the animal, there's consciousness even in Mrs. Bennett, but at not a very high level. There's consciousness in Darcy even when he calls her tolerable, but it's a vigilant consciousness. And when Wickham calls him a scoundrel, it's a false consciousness. There are varied expressions. So, but only when the consciousness is full, only when we have the full knowledge of the supermind, we will have the full mastery, because we have the full knowledge. So I think it's only the words that are confusing you, not the actual thought. And if we look at Mr. Bennett a little more carefully, one of the things that comes out of this is Mr. Bennett refuses to know. It's not that he doesn't know. He refuses to know. Another way to say this would be he refuses to take responsibility. Because if you really have the full knowledge, you will also take the responsibility. You will know. If I don't take responsibility here, if I just send her off because I want peace and quiet, it's going to come back as a nightmare or a catastrophe for me and the family. If he has the attitude to be responsible, what does it mean? It means what Lydia does is important to me. She's part of me. What happens to Charlotte or anyone else is part of me. Taking responsibility is a recognition of the fact that we're really not separate. We're really not isolated. So whether he knows that sending Lydia is dangerous, which is from the consciousness side, or whether he has the attitude, I'm responsible for everybody in the family, and even if I don't know, I have to be careful. He's moving out of the ego to a wider view. The truth of the matter is, for Mr. Bennett is, he's acting as if he's all alone in the world. He's like a sannyasi. Instead of going to the forest, he goes to the library. Instead of climbing the hill of Ayas where nobody finds him, he goes and says, "Don't come in. Leave me alone. I'm reading. I'm enjoying my novel. I'm doing my accounts. I want peace and quiet." He's irresponsible. And that, because he takes that attitude, he's like the Purusha who says, "I don't want anything to do with the universe. Let Prakriti do whatever she wants to do." And Prakriti does whatever she wants to do. She elopes with Wickham. And then he finds out that no matter if he lets Prakriti do whatever she wants, eventually it's going to come back and get him in trouble. But he can't escape that way. He has to really be the Ishwara. He can't afford to be the aloof, dispassionate, detached Purusha. The fact of the matter is, when he hides in the library for peace and quiet, he gives up all power. He becomes helpless. He becomes helpless in the hands of Lydia and Mrs. Bennet and all of the schemings that they do. He allows lowest elements, uncontrolled elements in his life to move. So he ultimately discovers at the end, if I want any kind of peace and quiet, if I want any kind of fulfillment, if I want any kind of happiness in the past, I have to take responsibility. I can't any longer shun it. He shunned it for 25 years. Okay, he educated Jane and Elizabeth a little, and then he gave up. It's too much struggle with his wife. So let her educate or do whatever she does with the others. He couldn't escape that. He had to take the consequences of his irresponsibility. What does Darcy do? In the beginning, he's just like that. He's a aloof Purusha, like the Atman. He goes to the dance and mingles, doesn't even want to mingle with anybody, as if he's untouched by everything. Well, it's a maya for him. By the end, he decides he can't afford to ignore anybody. He has to get Lydia married. He does. He has to deal with Wickham and pay for it. He takes responsibility. How is Wickham his responsibility? He realized the truth that his own fulfillment, his own highest romantic fulfillment, depends on taking responsibility for the person he would least like to relate to. And recognizing that in his life, making Mrs. Bennet his mother-in-law, Wickham his brother-in-law, rectifying his interference with Bingley and Jane, he takes responsibility. So when Abbott talks about taking consciousness responsibility, he's really affirming the fundamental principle that in truth we are all one. And our greatest fulfillment will come by knowing that oneness and acting in the good of all. When he talks about goodwill, having goodwill for others, the way Charlotte had for Lizzie and Jane, the way Lizzie had for Jane, it's the recognition. We're having goodwill for our own greater selves. And the greatest good will come to us by having the greatest goodwill for the greatest number. When he talks about self-giving, we're really giving to our greater self. And if you see all the characters in the story that try only to take, they get the minimum, they lose. And those that give, get the maximum. So there's a fundamental, it's not just a good moral principle, it's a fundamental truth of life, it's the reality, spiritual reality of life that this is based on. So we become masters by taking responsibility. Now he tells us that this chapter, the heart of this chapter is to explain that there are really three fundamental difficulties of life. And all of these difficulties arise from the problem of consciousness and force. That's why we've gone through this. He tells us how these difficulties are expressions of the problem of the relationship of consciousness and force. The first difficulty, I have called it here, he doesn't use the term in this chapter, he uses it in a later chapter, the psychological ignorance. We are aware of only a small part of our own being. That's consciousness. We live in the surface ego. We're not aware of our subconscious origins, we're not aware of the subliminal, we're not aware of our soul, we're not aware of the supernatural, we're not aware of the circumconscient around us. We know only a small part of our surface mentality, physicality, and vitality. And even on the surface, we don't know it all. And we quickly forget what we have learned in the past. This ignorance leads to major difficulties for us because consciousness is power. Look at Darcy. When he sees Elizabeth for the first time, he's not even aware that subconsciously he's attracted to her. The thought of being attracted to a girl at American Dance is so objectionable to him that he acts as if he doesn't say surely. He says she's followed, but really, something is very attractive, but no, this is not for me. This is objectionable. I can't be bothered with that. He's not only ignorant of what he feels, he's totally ignorant of who she is, of what she is. Gradually in the story, he begins to awaken to that. He's ignorant of the fact that he's going to fall deeply and passionately in love with her, and she's actually his soulmate, at least for this story. He's like a company that wants to run a business without understanding what the customers want. If a company really wants to succeed, it must understand the customer's needs better than they do. Not only that, but we are governed by the subconscious in us, by things we don't know are driving us. Lizzie's constantly angry with Darcy. So why should she be angry with a man that she has no relationship with? Why doesn't she just think of Darcy? She's all the time thinking of Darcy. Because what she's really angry with is that Darcy is not making love to her. That Darcy is not seeing how special she is and coming after her. She said it at one time. I wouldn't be so much bothered by his pride that it hurts my pride. He may be a proud man, but he has offended my pride. The truth of the matter is she's all the time totally wanting Darcy. And she, her way of attracting him is to abuse him, tease him, taunt him, laugh at him. She really thinks that. She even says to Charlotte, oh, I hope I would never dance with that man in my life. But she ends up dancing. So, she's unconscious of the fact that she's like her mother. That when she sees a red coat, she goes mad. And when she sees a handsome face of Wickham, she completely ignores the man and just goes by the appearance. Her problems come because she's unconscious of herself. Not because Darcy has called her tolerable, not because he's interfered with William Jane, but because she doesn't know herself. He doesn't know himself. So we only have power over that which we are aware of. And in ourselves, we cannot control ourselves if we don't know, ourselves, if we're not conscious of ourselves. Therefore, all progress is to know more about ourselves. And if Appa asks for us to consecrate the past and discover the things we've done wrong and the mistakes we've made or the wrong impulses we've had or the wrong attitudes we've had, it's not to condemn ourselves, it's to be conscious of human nature. Because only when we're conscious of human nature can we change, can we escape from it. Only then, as Darcy doesn't know he's proud. Everyone in the world knows Darcy's proud and a bit arrogant and selfish. And when he comes to the dance and looks around, he's offended. He really thinks he's a perfect gentleman. He really thinks he's a paragon of virtue. Only when she says, "You're the last man on earth," he shakes his head and begins to wake up. Not only did he understand her, he discovers himself. His great strength is his sincerity. Instead of dismissing what she has said to him, oh, she's been influenced by that liar, Wickham, just as a handsome man has told her things she believes, she could have dismissed it. Instead of dismissing all her accusations, he says, maybe there's a truth in what she says. Let me find out the truth in what she says and change it. Instead of complaining against her or blaming it on Wickham, let me see the truth. If she says I'm the last man on earth, is there any way for me to become the first man on earth? And he does. Whether he did it consciously or not, it happens. Because he acquired self-knowledge. So overcoming the psychological ignorance of what we are, it's like a gold mine. We have gold buried within us, within on our own property. Who wants to dig in the mud? I want to go and look, go and shine in the light and in the sunlight in the heavens. You're asking me to dig. I thought this was spirituality. You're asking me to dig in the mud. The gold is here. The knowledge is here. We must understand where we've come from in order to outgrow it. We must know our limitations in order to overcome them. We should understand the truth in life is that everything that comes to us in the world, all that comes to us from nature, is really comes from the Lord seated in the heart of all existence. As he says, Wickham is spreading lies about me, what can I do? Lizzie has a wrong understanding of me, how is that my fault? We must understand, if Wickham spreads lies, if Lizzie abuses, if Lydia elopes, there is in the depths of existence a Lord sitting in the heart of all things, orchestrating the evolution of life to awaken us to the delight of existence. Whatever comes to us from outside, even whatever comes to us from inside, when Darcy calls her sorrowful, he's unconscious. He doesn't know what it is that's driving him to say this in a loud voice where she also hears behind everything. Is the super consciousness of the super mind which is driving the evolution of life. So we must understand its message. When Lizzie comes to Mr. Bennett and he's all set planning for 2 months of peace and quiet over the summer and says, don't send Lydia to Brighton. Oh, she's interfering with my plans. She's spoiling everything. I was just going to think of some dramatic, happy, I won't listen to her. I will tease her. I will tell her you're only afraid your own lovers will be chased away. I'll mock her. I'll be sarcastic. I'll get rid of her some way so that I can have my peace and quiet. He doesn't realize it's the Lord seated in the heart of existence that's sending him a very important message. When Carolyn comes up at another field trial and warns Lizzie about Wickham, so you should know there's something wrong with that man. She gets angry. She gets furious. She gets self-righteous. She refuses to recognize. This is grace coming to her. Grace came to her through her mortal enemy, Carolyn. They came to her through what Jane told her about Wickham from Bingley. Grace came again from Mrs. Gardner, who warned her, you can't don't get interested in that man. Grace came through Darcy when he wrote the letter. Grace finally had to come in the form of Lydia's elopement because that's the only thing she could understand. Any other language she doesn't understand. Oh, now I begin to understand. He's not beautiful. He's angry. So, who is sending all that grace? It's Not that God sent elopement. God sent Carolyn, and you just threw mud in her. You just abused her and pushed her away. Marriage is trying to come to us. Are we willing to receive it? So, if we want to solve problems, we have to understand that every problem is a problem of our consciousness. And mostly, it's a problem of our subconscious beliefs. Dr. Sanyal was a doctor who served Sri Aurobindo during the later years of his life. And afterwards, out of a recognition of his service, Mother used to have him come for lunch every day, and he would be sitting with her when she ate lunch. He developed a serious brain tumor. And he said, I'm going to America for operation. He's meeting Mother every day for lunch. Mother says, it's better you don't go. She didn't say, but she saw if he goes, he'll die. He postponed. 6 months later, he says, Mother, the thing is very serious. I'm going to America for operation. He went. The doctor who was to operate there, one of the most advanced neurosurgeons, somehow it came in a conversation and somehow told him that, and that doctor said, what does your mother say? What does the mother say about this? She said, I shouldn't have an operation. He says, she's right. Sent him back. He's a man. Physically served Sri Aurobindo, sat with Mother every day, but where is his faith? His faith is in medicine, not in Mother. His subconscious, he says, I'm devoted, I think only of Mother, I have a picture of her, I pray to her every morning, I give her flowers every day when I need her, but I'm having this problem, I don't know why. Mother is limited in her path. Mother is not limited in his power. He's limited in his faith. It's not that he's limited in faith. He has faith. He has faith in medicine. He has faith in operation. When there is faith in operation, it's that that acts, not mother. The devotees running businesses, short of money, I can't get the money I need. I pray to mother, I don't understand. I'm not getting the money I need. What they really mean is I'm praying to money. And constantly, every day I go to the center and I pray for money. I mean, Mother, he really needs money. The prayer is the money, the thought is the money, it's constant remembrance of money, not constant remembrance of Mother. Constant remembrance of Mother means every time money normally would come up, then the thought should be only of Mother. So consciously, his faith is totally in money, not in Mother. So, once this psychological ignorance tells us our problems are governed by where we have our faith, either consciously or subconsciously. Darcy didn't know he was proud, didn't know he was arrogant. He was humiliated by life. But when Lizzie humiliated him, instead of feeling abusing her, he said, let me accept that humiliation and make a progress. Lizzie was humiliated when Lydia eloped. So she had to tell the one man in the world whom she looked up to as the highest, Darcy, my sister has eloped, and eloped with that scoundrel who you warned me about. How humiliating for her. That she has to confess to Darcy. Darcy has already said, your sisters are despicable and your mother doesn't behave properly. She had to defend her family. Now there's no defense for her. The worst possible thing has happened. So humiliation comes to us to help us awaken our consciousness. Humiliation is not a punishment. Humiliation is a form of grace to help us outgrow things that we're not conscious of. Darcy became conscious that he was, he said later at the end, at Longbourn, he said, I never realized I was proud and selfish and arrogant until you spoke to me. Now I understand and now I can change. So everything that comes to us to help us make a progress. This I have spoken. Second difficulty, the second of life's difficulties is the universal ignorance. We're not only ignorant of ourselves, of our subconscious, subliminal, and so forth. We are equally or more ignorant of everything else in the world. When Darcy, when Collins proposes to Lizzie, he has no idea that she would like to be on the other side of the earth, that she'd rather become a sannyasi than marry him. When Darcy proposes to her at Hunsford, he has no idea that she hates him. It never enters her mind that he may refuse her. He takes for granted that she's evenly waiting. When Charlotte agrees to marry Collins, Lizzie is shocked. She's not able to take it from Charlotte's point of view, look at it from her point of view, and see that this is a very good marriage for Charlotte. And she ends up happy in her situation. Darcy never dreamed that his sister Georgiana was capable of eloping, or that Wickham would wear such a thing, or that Mrs. Young, the governess, would conspire to make it happen. Neither Mrs. Bennet or Mr. Bennet know or think that Lydia is capable of elopement. Maybe Mrs. Bennet secretly would like to elope, and maybe she, but she doesn't consciously conceive that Lydia is capable of this. When Lady Catherine comes to Longbourn, she thinks she can just abuse Lizzie, command her, and Lizzie's going to just roll over and do what she says. She doesn't understand Lizzie at all, because Lizzie, the more you attack her, the more her strength comes out, the more her pride comes out. Everything Lady Catherine did only raised Lizzie's strength and pride, and she sent her back. When Darcy first hears that the Bennets have relatives living in Cheapside, you can't marry a man, you can't marry a girl who has aunt and uncle in Cheapside in business. Later he meets the Gardners and finds they're highly cultured. They're more cultured than Carolyn and Bingley, they're certainly more cultured than Lady Catherine. He not only learns to appreciate them, he goes to their house. He becomes friends with them. They become regular visitors to Pemberley. So he had a prejudice. So how can we have mastery in the world when we don't know the world? As we might say, it's very difficult to know the world. It may be difficult to know the world, but the first condition is you have to try. Did Collins really try to find out what Lizzie thinks about him? Did Darcy ever try to inquire what Lizzie feels about him? Lizzie ever try to understand Wickham's character until it was too late? In fact, later she reflects that she, I don't know why, I just never thought. She didn't want to know. She didn't want to think. This is all willful ignorance. Why should I worry about other people and try to understand them? I've got enough problems of my own. I'm not finding it difficult to understand myself. No. Every man for himself. We don't know ourselves and we also don't know other people. If we know ourselves fully, at least we can graduate ourselves. We don't know anything and we don't want to know. I don't want to know about all the bad things in my cup. I don't want to remember all the lies I've told or the false things I've done. I want to think nice things about myself. When Lizzie sees a handsome man in a red coat, she doesn't want to know the man's a scoundrel, and especially when that man singles her out for special attention. He's treating me special. He has a high regard for me. I don't like to think that a scoundrel has a high regard for me. I don't like to think that the man who's choosing me over all the other ladies is really a rogue. That's not very complimentary. She is flattered by his attention. So it's a willful ignorance. When Mrs. Collins tries to get instigate Collins to propose to Lizzie without telling anybody, Lizzie or Mr. Bennett, she doesn't want to know what Lizzie feels about this. She thinks that if I do it quickly and take her by surprise and lock them in the dining room for an hour, somehow he'll get her to accept and then I get the okay. This is willful ignorance of the world around us. That's why taking others' point of view, trying to take their point of view is so powerful. Trying to understand what they feel, what they think, is so powerful. At least we reverse this willful misunderstanding. The truth is that only Superman, only when we reach Superman, can we have a full knowledge of others, or a full knowledge of ourselves. That's the theme of this chapter. But we have a long way in between. So we don't have to say, what can I do? I'm not a super mental being. We can at least try to become a mental being. Try to become a rational being. Try to become human beings in the best sense of the word. Try to become thoughtful of other people. Have goodwill for other people. See, isn't it striking at the early dances? Charlotte is not looking around saying, who's going to dance with me and marry me? She's happily seeing that Julie's dancing with Jane, and she's giving advice to Lizzie. So I think Jane should encourage him more. Otherwise, he may misunderstand. She gave wonderful advice. She's thinking of another person. When Lizzie says, oh, that Darcy, I hope he doesn't ask me to dance. I never want to dance with him. I want to dance with Wickham. Charlotte says, see, don't make a mistake. Darcy's 10 times the man. She thinks from Lizzie's point of view. And who's the first one married? She's the first one married. She's not thinking, how do I get a man? Who's the man who's going to dance with me and marry me? She's thinking about Jane and Lizzie, and she's the first one married. And Mrs. Bennett was thinking only of getting all the men belong to my daughters. Everybody else to the back. She has to wait a year to get a daughter married. Lady Lucas, who sits there quietly minding her own business, being pleasant, she gets her daughter married first. So there's a lot we can do long before we meet Superman to overcome this willful ignorance. And as we overcome it, we get more mastery in life. This is the main theme of the chapter. Now there's a third difficulty of life. And this one's a little more difficult than the others because it has several expressions. Not only are we ignorant, not only do we lack consciousness, but consciousness in us and force in us are separate from one another. In supermind, if you know something, you automatically have the strength or will or capacity to do it. But for us in life, we find that's not the case. I may know how to play tennis, but it doesn't mean I can win the game. I may know that certain foods are good for me and certain are not, but it doesn't mean I can resist, that I will do only what's good for me and never what's not good for me. But the division between what we know and what we will, what we are aware of and what we have power to accomplish. We see this because it expresses in two ways. One is, our body, our life, and our mind are all divided from one another. It's not only that we're divided from other people, it's not only that we're divided from our subconscious. Even on the surface, we have a war going on between the mind, the life, and the body. This is beautifully shown in the story when Darcy goes and proposes to her at the huntsman. He says, I cannot help myself. I feel such a passion, meaning my vital needs you, wants you. But my mind keeps telling me this is a mistake. I'm making a mistake in doing it. His mind and his vital are at war with one another. It's no small wonder that she refuses it. It's not a good compliment that she comes and says, I love you passionately even though you're so objectionable in all these ways. That doesn't win a lady's heart. It's not very flattering. It's more like an addiction than a romance, that he says. I can't help myself. Maybe one day I'll be more sensible than now. This is common for us. Because our physical nature, our vital nature, and our mental nature are all different from one another. Each of them has a different consciousness and a different way of doing things. Appa frequently says, if the physical knows something, it acts immediately. Knowledge for the physical is action. If I know how to fight, it just fights, it doesn't think. The vital, it can never wait. It wants something immediately. The mind is capable of patience, at least to some extent. The soul really has patience. But the force in the physical is not under our control. If you put a beautiful mango in front of me and say, this is for you, and leave me alone, it doesn't take 3 minutes or 4 minutes for me to figure out whether I should eat it. If you put a mango there and you say, this is for somebody else who hasn't come yet, then I'll be restraining myself that I'm constantly looking at the mango. Maybe the person's not coming. But you said they were coming, it's already 10 minutes. Maybe, I don't think they come. If the mind is involved, say, mango is not really good for me, I've already had enough to really need this just because the vital wants it, the physical likes the taste, I shouldn't take the mango. Then there'll be a real conflict between the mind and the vital. So each part of our nature has a different character, like with different people. You see how different Mrs. Bennett and Mr. Bennett are, they're like night and day. They're always in conflict. We have the same thing in ourselves. Lucy has Mrs. Bennett in her vital, she has Mr. Bennett in her mind, the thinking part, and it's also at war. When she meets Darcy's dinner, she's thinking of that handsome man who's so good. He must be good because he's handsome. That's physical. And she says, any man who looks that good must be good. That's the physical. It takes everything at its superficial appearance. She says he must be good not only because he's handsome, but because he was nice to her. What does being nice have to do with being good? A liar can also be nice. So he was a liar being nice. In fact, he wasn't in love with her at all. He was flattering her. So the vital is pierced. When she reads the letter and she knows this is the man who eloped with Georgiana, tried to elope with the family and behind the back of the family that has raised them. This is the man who has rejected the living that Mr. Darcy, old Mr. Darcy, offered him, who took money from Darcy for law school and then squandered it. This is the man who has flattered me and looks so handsome. You see the difference in perspective between the physical, the vital, and the mental. That's one of our problems. Our problems come because we have constant We think of only the warfare between husbands and wives and kids and children and parents, and at work between the boss and the subordinates and the other employees, and in the marketplace between the shopkeeper who wants to charge more and we want a discount, or vice versa, if we're shopkeepers. We don't realize the same war is going on within ourselves. How do we resolve that? How do we overcome that fundamental delusion? We have to go, we cannot have it. The mind, we certainly can't do it like Lydia, I will do what I want. I'll go and just forget everybody, forget everything and I'll alone. We can't do it like Mrs. Bennett, who's constantly stalling and, for what she wants. We can't do it with Mr. Bennett's rationalization. No, if I don't send her to Brighton, we'll never have peace here. We cannot do it by the power of the physical or even the vital. The vital says, I'm stronger, I'll get my way. I know how to dominate the other person and get our way. The moment we try to get something by domination, we're using force. The other man may have a clever argument, but I listen to that. I'll just attack him. And that's what Mr. Bennett does to Lizzie. And she says, you shouldn't send her. She says, oh, you're afraid of you're losing your lovers. It's not a rational argument. It's a vital attack. It's a sarcasm. He tries to use cleverness to undermine a rational argument. But the truth is, she doesn't fully tell him all she knows. She doesn't tell him that this man tried to elope with Georgiana, and I know this count, and I have been a fool to have been chasing after that man. She also is talking from the vital, not the mental. So what's the answer for us? He says the answer is we have to get to the psychic. That's the next step, which we'll do next month. We have, because behind the vital, behind the mental, behind the physical, is the true being, our true being, our central being. It's the psychic. Only the psychic has the full knowledge. Only the psychic knows the truth. So, anytime you catch yourself saying, I know what should be done, it's probably not the psychic that's speaking. Listen to me. Of course, none of us ever say that. No? That's why the right thing for us to do is to say, Mother, I don't know anything. It's either I'm going to listen to my physical idiocy, or I'm going to follow my vital impulse, or I'm going to assert my mental ignorance. You better not listen to me, and please, I give up all of this. Thy will be done, not mine. I try to move away from the surface. I try to move away from my physical, vital, mental being, which is all in conflict. It's a constant civil war. It's a big masala. I try to go back to Mother, to my psychic, where the truth is there. And if I don't know what the truth is, what do? Be quiet, I say. Don't take initiative. Don't abuse other people. Don't even react when they abuse you, because they're giving you a straight path to the psychic. If they abuse you, it helps you. Give up the ego, give up the pride, give up the ignorance, and go to the depth of your deep. And if you can't get to the depth, go as deep as you can and then call Mother. Mother, thy will be done. I may not see any light, I don't see a glorious sun every minute guiding me. When I just stop where I am, Mother, you act, not me. That way we can overcome the division between our parts. But there's more to it. There's also a division between the conscious being that created the universe and the nature we see in the universe. The divine, in manifesting, he starts with Purusha being the witness and nature going on and creating the world. So we have another complication for us. Our mind is divided against itself. Our vital is divided against itself. Even our physical is divided against ourselves. We have contradictory thoughts. We your contradictory desires. Lizzie may say, I want to marry a handsome man in a uniform, but the man has no money. What are we going to live on? I would also like to marry the mistress of Thunderlake. Even at the vital level, even when she's being vital, there's a conflict within her, because everything is at war with everything else. I think my mind is in conflict. I get confused. I get confused between consciousness and mentality. We all get confused with so many things. I say, Abba says this, I should do this, but I thought I should do this, and I'm not sure how to do them both. Again, the answer for us is, get away from the surface. Get away from the confusion, because we are in the half-conscious, half-ignorant consciousness, which doesn't know the truth. So instead of asserting the truth and asking everybody to do what we say and follow our guidance, we should all the time be asking Mother for the guidance, withdrawing, and understand what she said. The solution for this difficulty, in fact, he tells us very patiently, the solution for all the three difficulties, the division, the fact that we don't know ourselves, the fact that we don't know others, and the fact that everything's divided up and conflict with everything else, the solution to all of these is the same. It lies in rising from the half-conscious mentality, which is what we are. We live in the ego, we live in a divided consciousness, separate from everybody else. We live in ignorance. The solution to all of them is to go to supermind. Because in supermind, there's no division, there's no, we are one with everybody, there's no ignorance, we have the total knowledge, and we have the total power and mastery. Practically for us, that means we should take the first step. The first step is to know where we are, to be conscious of where we are. That's the message of this chapter. To recognize the limitations, to not make the mistake of Lydia, who thinks happiness is going and following your impulses, or Mrs. Bennett, who thinks that happiness is dominating and competing with everybody else, or Mr. Bennett, who wants to hide in the library, or Darcy, who wants to be proud and arrogant and self-important, or Lizzie, who wants to be flattered by a handsome man. We can learn from every one of the characters in the story, because they're all us. They're all human nature. And there's nothing we find in the characters which we won't find in ourselves, because we share the ignorance seen in the third status on the way to the fourth status. And the method for all of us is the same. We have to get out of the third spider. How do we do it? We have to want to get out. What's the first condition? We shouldn't be very proud of being where we are. We shouldn't be insisting on our ignorance. We should be trying to move out. And he gives us a method for that. The method for that is harmony. We have to first seek harmony within ourselves, harmony between our thoughts, our feelings, harmony between the parts of doing, harmony between ourselves and other people, harmony between what we know and what we do. I know all these things Abba says I should do, Mother says I should do, she writes in Psychic Education, she tells us a very simple 10-step process to go to the psychic. I say it's very difficult. At the end of the day, how many of those rules did I follow? Did I even make an effort? No, I forget. I forget what she said. I read it, but meaning I don't want to remember what she said, because if I remember, then I'm supposed to do it. As long as I say I don't know, Abba used to frequently tell me, he says, when you do it, I said, I don't understand. He says, that means you're not willing. When you say we don't understand or we don't know, that means we're not willing. It's willful ignorance. So, we need to get to harmony. Oh, that's simple. If everybody will follow my instructions, we'll have peace and quiet and a happy home. Isn't that harmony? That's Mrs. Bennett's version of harmony. Or every man for himself, let us all do, leave everybody else alone. That's Mrs. version of harmony. Or just I'll be in the quiet here. I mind my own business. I'm a good man. I don't trouble anybody. I don't abuse anybody. I don't owe any money to anybody. Just leave me in peace and quiet. And then there's chaos in the house and chaos throughout the town. That's Mr. Bennett's version of harmony. Harmony doesn't come through ignorance. Harmony doesn't come through impulsiveness. Harmony doesn't come by calling other people savages or thinking they're inferior. Harmony doesn't come from insisting on our will. Harmony comes from being more conscious of ourselves, trying to be more conscious of other people. Harmony comes from having goodwill, from really wanting the best for others. And Appa has found a wonderful strategy for us to accomplish the most. If we ardently pray for other people to get what we most want ourselves, genuinely, it takes us out of the center of conflict. It takes us out of the surface ego that competes. And it puts us deep to the psychic. Only the psychic can pray and have goodwill for others. Only the psychic can really want the benefit of others because it's one with others. Other people's achievement is its achievement, being happy when others are happy. So, seeking harmony within ourselves, seeking harmony with others by goodwill, by self-giving, by taking their point of view. Trying to identify with their aspirations, listen to their ideas, accept their feelings, help them fulfill what they seek. This is how we move into harmony. And if we succeed, truly, we are on our way to the fourth status of life, which is the supramental status of life. The supramental unity in which love and harmony and enlightenment and full mastery exist for us. There is no problem in life at all. As a step to that, Appa has offered us mother's life. Yogic life. Yogic life is the stepping stone for the human being who wants to give up the ignorance and the separateness and a veil of mother's supramental power to solve any problem and create any opportunity where we are now. And that is the sure path, whether it's in this life or another life, to the fourth status, which is where we're all headed in future. I'll stop here. We have a few minutes. If there are any questions, either here or from anywhere, anyone on the WebEx. The question is, how to get more harmony with myself? You recognize the conflict that Shobhanda talks about. That's real. But what to do about it? How do we harmonize ourselves? The simple, best, most powerful answer to this is consecration. Consecration is the master key to move from where we are. Why? Because when my mind tells me one thing and my Bible tells me another, how am I going to solve it? I'm certainly not going to solve it by a tug of war between them like Mr. and Mrs. Bennett. Consecration means, let me move away from what my Bible says, let me move away from what my mind says, and let me say, Mother, thy will be done. The harmony comes in moving away from the surface. What we try to do is, we try to do it on the surface. If I want to go for some entertainment, my wife wants to go to a movie, how do we resolve that? Or if I want to do both, How do I resolve that? It cannot be resolved on the surface. In life, it gets resolved the stronger person determines, dominates, and then the consequences come later. It never solves the problem. He only is left standing with the darkness. He's the stronger person, God, and it comes back in double measure as a problem. Consecration is the best method. Wherever there's a conflict, don't either sort out which is the better thing. Go and think of Mother, give it to Mother, present it to Mother, rely on her.
I have a question for you. You see, you are suggesting that the problems of division can be sorted out by the person rising to the supramental level. This is far easier said than done. So why suggest something so difficult? People have great difficulty even transforming themselves to become normal good people. So that being the case, asking them to rise to the supramental level to see some unity, this looks like an impossible task.
What I try to emphasize is, we don't really understand the source of our problems. Our problem is not that we're not in Superman. We think our problems are with other people. We think our problems is that other people don't recognize how valuable we are or don't cooperate with us. We don't realize the problem is with our own consciousness, and it cannot be solved in any other way. When we pray to Mother, what we mean is, Mother, I am what I am, you give me what I want. Mostly that's what we mean when we pray. I am what I am and I'm not trying to change. You give me what I want. But when we understand that what we receive, Mother may want to give. Her girls try to give. She's been pouring things on all of us. Whenever she gives here, I turn the other way. There's that story, I don't take time for it now, about the devotee who's all the time calling Shiva, and when Shiva tries to give him a gold bar, he closes his eyes and walks past it. We're like that. The problem is we don't realize that our problems are the result of our own consciousness. So this chapter gives us that knowledge. I spoke in the chapter, I tried to emphasize practically. The characters in the story suffer because of willful ignorance, not because they're not supramental beings, because they don't want to be conscious, they don't want to know the truth, they don't want to accept the reality that's presented to them, rather they constantly refute it and blame other people. That's what happens in the story, that's probably what's happening in our lives too. So, all we need to do, most of us going to become immortal beings tomorrow, but we'll be happy if we can solve all our problems. It's enough we know the problem lies with our consciousness, and we follow the methods that Appa has given. Consecration, remembrance of Mother, thy will be done, self-giving, goodwill, taking the other person's point of view, harmony with other people rather than asserting over them. These are practical methods that will solve all the problems and create all the opportunities that any of us need. I tried to say, the answer to what you said, I tried to anticipate it by saying, we may not get to Superman tomorrow, but we can get to yogic life, we can get to Mother's life. But then we have to have faith, not in money, not in the doctors, not in our own capacity, certainly not in our capacity to bluff or tell stories like Wickham and a few people. If we have faith in Mother and put our faith there and stop asserting our ego, stop being on the surface, try to say thy will be done, our problems will be over and our opportunities will come. Then we can talk about Superman later on. The life divine comes in the 56th chapter. We're only in chapter 22. And I think we're only at about page 200 and something, and it's a 1,000-page book. So we'd be happy if we all make this much progress at page 200. Imagine where we'll be when we reach page 1,000.
Thanks, Dad.
Okay. Good question, Jim. Thanks very much. Okay. We've talked about taking responsibility, and Appa has said we can only take responsibility in the measure of our strength. And how to know how much responsibility to take and how to draw the line? Excellent question. The short answer is, Appa talks about consciousness responsibility. Consciousness responsibility is not necessarily going out and trying to get jobs for everybody, give monies to everybody, arrange marriages for everybody. Consciousness responsibility is an attitude of goodwill first and trying to want the best for other people and do what we can do. Mostly what we can do is we can pray and we can consecrate. What does Mr. Bennett do? He hides in the library, don't talk to me about this. What does he do at the end of the story? He comes out of the library and says, no more officers in the house. He had the strength all the time. His problem was not a lack of strength, it was laziness. So, in the measure we are not acting out of laziness or out of selfishness, or I don't care, I have enough problems, don't talk to me about problems of others. Taking consciousness responsibility, I exhaust my effort at the highest level I'm capable of. If there's a problem in the family, let me consecrate, let me call mother. Instead of saying it's somebody else's problem, my calling mother is going to make me stronger, and it's going to raise the atmosphere in the house. I can't say I can't call mother, and I can't say I don't have the strength. Do I have the willingness to do that? Outwardly, I'm coming to the second part of your question. Outwardly, whether you do something for another person has to be in the measure you have capacity, in the measure you have strength. And if you observe, you will see how far life sanctions this and supports it, and how far the attitude of the other person supports it. But even with your worst enemy, if somebody has a problem, say if Lydia elopes, Mrs. Phillips or Lady Lucas may be feeling happy. Oh, finally a little excitement in town. Now that the dominating lady will be put in her place for a while. So it's not that it's their responsibility to get Lydia back. She can definitely take the attitude, say, something like that could happen in my family also. Am I like Mrs. Bennett? Let me be our mother. Let me consecrate. If there's ill will or some glee in me at her misfortune, let me consecrate that and become a better person. There's always something we can do. Even when we try to read Pride and Prejudice and learn from the characters, we tend to learn from the characters we like and we have a preference for. We identify with certain characters and not the others, and we interpret things in the way we want, which is exactly what the characters do. But I would say it's quite natural and very flattering for everybody to think they're a Lizzie. But I think accepting that to start with, there's enough humanity in Lizzie. There's enough we can learn from Lizzie's mistakes. Darcy's the real hero of the story. But there's a lot we can learn from Darcy's mistakes. If you happen to be like Lizzie, then it also stands to reason I must be capable of being in love with Fawcett, because she is. So humanity is a totality. Of course, the truth is that we are all a totality. The truth is that though Jane Austen may have consciously put, created Lydia and Lizzie to be like herself, there must be an element of Lydia in her also. Sincerity is to find out the value of every character for us, what we can learn from. Okay, thank you.